to episode 237 of The Liminalist. This week I'm talking to Stephen Snyder, also known as Recluse of Vicep, about his new book, Strange Tales of the Parapolitical, Postwar Nazis, Mercenaries, and Other Secret History.
Doesn't need no other, there's a rock inside my chest.
Got lots of things to talk about, you know, different angles of approach, and you know, very different subjects from traumatic engineering. Trauma-based society, as the original title of your book was going to be, to my work with Dave O'Shana and how to relax the nervous system. So there's a full spectrum there. I know that the primary incentive for this conversation is that you've just released the book. So, but I also think, I mean, I figure whatever we talk about, it's an opportunity for people to become aware of your book. So I suggest we just go wherever we need to go. But let's start with your book and what it is and what it's about.
Well, it's called Strange Tales of the Parapolitical, Postwar Nazis, Mercenaries, and Other Secret History. The genesis of the project kind of went back to around October 2019 when I was on my honeymoon, ironically. And I was approached by my partner, Frank Zero. We also do the Farm Podcast, which you can find at thefarmpodcast.com. You know, and he basically asked me, you know, do you want to try to put a book together? Originally, it had been sort of an ideal that we would take some old blog posts and clean them up for publication, but I was never really, you know, into that. I don't like to try to turn around and charge people something that I've already put up for free, even if there's some slight revisions to it, you know. So I wanted to do some fresh essays, and his whole kind of concept for it was, you know, let's start with the theories of Naomi Klein, with the shock doctrine and that type of thing, and, you know, how could we expand that to you know, just general trauma-based methods and so forth, reconcile it more with some of the speculation with MK Ultra and that type of thing. And after kind of going over this a little bit, a kind of an obvious topic to me was Colonia Dignidad, the infamous Nazi colony from Chile that was set up in the early 1960s. Of course, Klein had focused a lot on Chile during the, you know, the regime of Pinochet. In fact, that was, I think, essentially the country that she had argued was the first one to, the first recipient of the shock doctrine in its, you know, modified and refined form. So, you know, that seemed like a compelling enough argument with Chile. And then on top of that, it was kind of like, well, what could we look at Colonia Dignidad, you know, kind of taking this from a microcosm to a macrocosmic spectrum, from sort of the broader what was going on to the nation to what, you know, were the personal traumas that Colonia Dignidad was imposing as part of this, you know, broader program. And, you know, kind of looking at this, one of the more interesting discoveries I had made around that time related to the Mellon family and how MK Ultra had been incorporated into psychological war. And that seemed like another, you know, compelling subject for an essay, especially since, you know, the Mellon family has got their fingers in quite a few pies over the years. So there's a lot you could really unpack with them. And finally, and it was kind of like just a last-minute decision, but I had thought about going into private, you know, military companies and private intelligence companies. And that really, I thought, proved to be the most interesting of the essays, especially from the perspective of trauma, just how the one kind of private intelligence firm, what is it, Science Application International Corporation or something like that, SAIC, it's now known as Lydias or something like that. It's been a major tech firm and defense contractor since at least I think the late 1960s, early 1970s, but it really emerged as a major private intelligence company during the 90s. And it was really instrumental in pushing the second Iraq war on the American public. Of course, they had been lobbying for it going back to the late 90s. And I think there's very compelling evidence as well that they had played a leading role in the anthrax false flag attack that had, you know, unfolded here in the United States in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I think the envelopes started to be mailed out roughly a week later or something like that. And, of course, one of the employees at SAAC at the time was Stephen Hatfield, who was initially a major FBI suspect in all of this with the anthrax letters and so forth. And he was eventually exonerated, though there's a lot of debate about that. They ended up tapping another guy who also worked at a highly classified defense, you know, research arsenal, who I believe committed suicide before he was formally charged. So, like a lot of this type of stuff, we probably will never really know the full truth. But, you know, the figure of Stephen Hatfield was just a really fascinating guy in general, and how all of this really played into the anthrax attacks. And of course, strangely, though, that kind of seems even more relevant now with the COVID-19 thing breaking out. So certainly, you know, in hindsight, it's definitely a good thing, I think, that I did include the extended section on SAIC and all of the stuff with the anthrax attacks in the work. Certainly, it's very timely at this, you know, current moment.
Mm-hmm. So, just briefly about the Naomi Klein reference, because I'm not familiar with her work. Obviously, I know about the shock doctrine. Actually, somebody mentioned it in the thrift store just yesterday in reference to the COVID-19 situation. Is that a term that she coined, shock doctrine? Is that her thesis?
I believe so. I mean, it's not really an especially original thesis, in all honesty. In fact, that's one of the things I really got into in the book, that it seems like really what she had defined as the shock doctrine was kind of a variation on an ideology that Italian neo-fascists had developed in the mid-60s that was referred to as the strategy of tension, and that in turn had a basis in an even older, you know, concept that had been established by the French, essentially in the immediate aftermath of the disastrous French Indochina War. They were studying the guerrilla tactics of Mao Zedong and how they had lost the conflict in what is now Vietnam. And they had come up with another interesting concept known as, Le guerre revolutionnaire, revolutionary warfare. And that really kind of seemed like it was the underpinning ideology for a lot of these, you know, various counterinsurgency doctrines that have become so prevalent in the Cold War. And certainly in the case of Chile specifically, a lot of the French military strategists had actually been shipped to the Southern Cone, not just Chile, but Argentina and so forth, really in the aftermath of the attempted push against De Gaulle in the early 60s, where they had essentially personally instructed a lot of these guys and the techniques. And I mean, of course, this doctrine was, you know, first used in large scale during the Algerian conflict in the late 50s, early 60s. And I mean, it was horrendous. I mean, you know, a common tactic used was to abduct somebody randomly off the street, a suspected insurgent. They would then be brutally tortured for roughly 24 hours. Usually it ended after 24 hours because it was believed that that was when the, you know, time had elapsed for when useful information could be harvested from a subject. They were, you know, subjected to things like the beloved water pipe method, which we now know in the States as waterboarding, of course, the inevitable electroshock treatment. And after about 24 hours of this, they committed suicide, which consisted of being flown out in a helicopter over the Mediterranean and thrown out of it, but not too far from the shore, because it was felt that it was a great psychological thing to have the mangled body washed up on the shore so that their loved ones and their potential allies and what have you could see what happens, you know. That was actually something that many of the Latin American dictators also became quite obsessed with later as well.
Well, so, I mean, tracing it back, I mean, this is where I'm going to want to get to, and might as well get straight to it, really. We're talking about certain principles that we can see that you're mapping that are applied in warfare and intelligence and counterintelligence and so on. But it seems to me that you're attempting to uncover something that I've also been trying to uncover in my work, which is like a unifying principle of social control, and that so that it extends, you know, beyond the domain of military and intelligence and into society at large, hence that title, You Were Going to Have a Trauma-Based Society. And that related to that, or central to that, is that this principle is an ancient principle that far precedes, I don't know about warfare, but certainly modern warfare, insofar as it's also applied, can it be applied on an individual level, you know, in terms of if you want to indoctrinate people and install levers of control, then you traumatize them, and you, I mean, even the cliche of the Zen master hitting the disciple on the stick comes to mind as a relatively benign equivalent of this underlying psychological principle that I think that your work currently is circling around. Is that right?
Yes, no, I mean, I could certainly see that. And I mean, you know, I mean, the mystery traditions of the ancient world obviously kind of jump out as an obvious, you know, kind of touchstone for this type of thing, especially when you get into kind of like the Mithraic cults and that type of thing, where, you know, clearly trauma was used at different stages of initiation and so forth. And, you know, certainly with the Mithras cults, because they were so closely aligned with the military, too, I think that was especially sensitive for the desensitization to make these individuals into, you know, more complete soldiers and such like.
Right. So I mean, there's you've mapped a lot in your book, as I've mapped in my book, and I guess people who are interested can go to the book itself and see all the ways you've mapped it in the case studies. What I think would be interesting for us to get into, well, I think there's two avenues of approach, and they're separate, so we'd have to take them one at a time. One is what's going on currently with COVID-19. We could look at it as a current example, and the other, perhaps we should get to that later, is in terms of you know, what we can do about it, what's actually happening in our own nervous systems that we can address it in our daily lives. And that's the stuff that I sent you at my blog and whatnot. So if you like, should we start with the COVID-19 and just try and use that as an example of what you've been discovering? Do you feel up to that, or is it still a bit fresh what's going on currently?
No, I feel fine discussing that. Definitely, okay. I've already been doing a couple of chats on COVID-19, so yeah, I mean, a lot of the information is pretty fresh now.
Okay, well, let's start there. Yeah, well, what's your take on it currently, and how does it dovetail with what your book is about?
Well, I think it definitely dovetails with, you know, kind of the intercedent civil war that's been going on between different factions amongst the ruling elite. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of interpretations as to how COVID got started. I mean, was it a potential false flag that the United States had launched? Was it something that China did? I could certainly see, you know, either being a distinct possibility, but you know, obviously, there does seem like there is a certain element of a last-ditch effort between the kind of globalist faction in all of this. You know, obviously, there's been a lot of blows taken against this faction in recent years. I mean, most recently with the UK leaving the EU, and just generally the generally precarious state that the EU is in right now. So, but I mean, kind of getting more, I think, to, you know, obviously something that's really closely related to the book would be the use of propaganda and all of this, and especially this just really horrendous, traumatic propaganda. And this was, you know, something I kind of tried to outline in the book and trace the history of it roughly in the Cold War, with an examination of the American Security Council, which was, it was kind of the equivalent of the far right's answer to the Council of Foreign Relations during the Cold War, but it was also effectively a vast private intelligence network as well. And there was a lot of overlap with it, with both Artichoke and MK Ultra personnel as well. And that was something in terms of MK Ultra that was really focused on in the book, with a guy named Frank Burnett, who was a Rhodes Scholar. He would found the, the National Strategic Information Center. But he had hooked up with the MK Ultra guys, specifically the Society for Human Ecology, in the 1950s, when he was essentially doing these indoctrination lectures at the National War Colleges. And these lectures were designed specifically for military officers to, you know, make sure that they were indoctrinated with firm anti-communist positions and so on and so forth. And one of the guys he was working with in this was a Colonel James Monroe, Poe, who was a top figure in the Society for Human Ecology, and Monroe continued to patronize him afterwards when he became involved with the American Security Council. And the ASC is not really very well known nowadays. It really petered out in the late 1980s, but it's really had just a phenomenal degree of influence on what we would kind of think of as conspiratorial alternative culture in this day and age. Of course, on the one hand, there was a tremendous amount of overlap with the John Birch Society, and this is where you really get a lot of the anti-UN, the anti-Federal Reserve, the anti, you know, Rockefeller propaganda that's become such a staple of modern conspiracy culture. Almost all of that goes back to the Birchers and, in turn, the American Security Council.
Right.
But on the flip side of the coin, a lot of the UFO stuff comes from them as well, and this is something that's really been vastly overlooked, but they had a tremendous role in the UFO community for years. Of course, there were several alleged MJ-12 members. Personally, I don't believe in MJ-12, but, you know, for what it's worth, there were a couple of alleged MJ-12 members in the ASC. You had guys like Curtis LeMay, Barry Goldwater, who almost completely started the Hangar 19 mythos. There was tons of overlap with NICAP and a lot of the other early UFO organizations. So certainly the ASC just played a tremendous role in shaping all of these narratives throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and going up into the early 1980s. And, you know, I mean, they had some very curious figures working in the group to help with this, of course. I mean, one of the more infamous would be James Jesus Angleton, who was the inspiration for the Matt Damon character in The Good Shepherd. He was just one of the most powerful CIA officers in the history of the agency and a specialist in counterintelligence. And another one, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, was Colonel Michael Aquino, who's, of course, a Psy War officer. So it's hardly surprising that he ended up with the ASC in the 1980s in a lot of ways. But the ASC especially just really, you know, specialized in this very traumatic-centric propaganda, threats of nuclear wars, of, you know, invasions from the communists. I mean, it was just instrumental in kind of creating this whole militia culture and the stockpiling of firearms and stuff across the country. And continuously, they were just bombarded with this propaganda of, you know, Chinese troops amassing at the Mexican border and just all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, when you look at Barnett, eventually he stretched out and got into some more, I guess you would say, reputable propaganda efforts, if you will. And this really actually crystallized in the UK with the Institute for the Study of Conflict and Brian Crozer, a guy we've talked about before. And there, you know, Barnett got access to some pretty significant press barons as well. One of them was Sir James Goldsmith. But even more interesting was Rupert Murdoch, of course, the, you know, infamous Fox News founder and so forth. And I've always, you know, kind of marveled at that because, I mean, Murdoch seems like he really embraced this sensational approach to journalism around the time that he had hooked up with Barnett and Crozer. And this really, you know, I think kind of manifested later in the night, towards the end of the 70s with, you know, the Son of Sam case in New York. I mean, a lot of people kind of forget this, but Murdoch was really the guy who had hung his hat on the case as a press baron. He had some very sensational reports about this, and his newspapers were actually also the first ones to put forth the theory that a cult had been behind it and so forth. So actually, no, I mean, Maury Terry actually thanks Rupert Murdoch personally a couple of times in The Ultimate Evil and what have you. Yes, it was Murdoch's close friend Stephen Dunleavy who had actually gotten Terry access to David Berkowitz when he was in prison and so forth. So Murdoch had a huge role in shaping the narrative to that, which, yes, is not very much talked about.
Wow. But, so just pause on that. So you don't mean the mainstream narrative so much around Son of Sam, but the Maury Terry occult conspiracy narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of akin to what happened with JFK in the way that Peter Dale Scott has kind of defined it, where you had the, you know, the phase one story with JFK where, you know, Oswald was just a lone nut and, you know, there was nothing to it. And then from there you had the phase two story, which was disseminated by groups like the American Security Council, was that Oswald was a Manchurian candidate who was under the control of the Soviets, and it was actually the Russians and Castro, who had sponsored the assassination. And that, I think, was very similar to what Murdoch was trying to do with Terry in the Son of Sam case, where, you know, you had kind of the phase one story, it's just a lone nut, which my understanding is, I mean, almost nobody in New York City in that time frame really believed that. There were just so many eyewitness accounts of multiple shooters. The police didn't believe it. So from there, you know, you cook up the phase two story and you start acknowledging, yes, you know, there were multiple shooters. There was some kind of a cult. But, you know, then you start kind of misconstruing what, you know, might have been behind it and so forth. In that sense, at least, I've always been very dubious about how much involvement that the process may have had in that, or whether, you know, they were just kind of somebody that was selected because they already had some degree of infamy from, you know, Ed Saunders' book, The Family, and you had former members there. Was it just a convenient scapegoat? You know, there's definitely, I think, a possibility to that.
Right. All right, okay. So carry on anyway. I mean, we're bringing it to the COVID-19, and you're suggesting that there's something similar going on now, as in there's the mainstream narrative, which we don't even have to get into, and that there's an alternate, there's a second narrative that's being created. Is that where we're getting to?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I don't even know if it's just a second. You know, I mean, you've got like your phase two, your phase three, your phase four stories. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's like, okay, it was just a random occurrence because somebody ate a bat or something like that. Or, so like, you know, phase one, it was the Russia, or that's your phase one. Phase two, it was the Chinese that did it. Phase three, it was the United States. Phase four, it's the 5G networks. I mean, yeah, it's there's definitely, and I mean, I think that's just kind of further sowing confusion. I mean, people obviously recognize that the phase one story, the mainstream narrative, is not very plausible, but you're now just being completely bombarded really with the information overload with all of these other different, you know, conspiracies surrounding it. And that's, I think, just kind of further muddying the water, essentially.
Yeah, well, I experienced this directly in the thrift store because we're still open. And so our customers, I mean, I talk to our customers and what they think is going on with this. And obviously, it's a limited demographic because people who are coming to the shop, they're not self-quarantining. They're not trying to flatten the curve. So clearly, they're, you know, whatever, that's a particular demographic. But what I've noticed is that they tend to, yes, be very skeptical of the phase one story, the mainstream narrative, completely skeptical. But a number of them, a large number of them, immediately cite some YouTube thing that they've seen or a series of what, and then they go into their whichever phase of the story it is, you know, which is whatever it is, doesn't really matter. I'm just kind of confirming your point at an experiential level and how tricky it is. I think how effective it is in divide and conquer, in the you know, if people can agree not to know, then that's an area of agreement right there, and there's room for exploration and discovery. But if people don't want to be in the liminal space of not knowing, if they're clinging to the mainstream narrative, trust your government, and then they have friends or family members who are going to YouTube, you know, for their source of information, and they become completely convinced that they know what's going on, right, then there's a divide there that's unbridgeable.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, in some cases, it's probably within, I mean, certainly I would say now, especially, it's probably within individual households and what have you, with some people taking it more seriously than others. And yeah, I mean, it's, I think, you know, and especially as the weeks go on, I mean, it's going to be just a division on so many levels, societal, family. And, you know, right now we're still not even really feeling the pressure. I mean, we're starting to feel some of the pressure from the economic, you know, issues that are being spawned by it. But I mean, certainly, I think in the coming weeks, you know, when people burn through their, what, $1,200 Trump checks or something here, things could start getting really testy out there, to put it mildly.
So how do you address this as a researcher then? Because I've just done this piece. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but and it's an attempt to put this thing in a larger context. But I did end up, obviously, I'm reliant on, you know, outside sources and the internet, and I ended up citing, for example, this Rockefeller report, which somebody like David Icke also cites. And there's a good chance, there's a definite chance that I'm also being played, I'm being fed information in order to help reinforce one of the phases of these narratives, right? And I don't want to do that, but I'm trying to bring some coherence to what's going on. So how do you approach that yourself in terms of trying to make it more coherent without actually locking it down into some narrative that is either pre-created and you've inadvertently fed into it, or you're just assisting with the creation of these narratives that are being used to divide people?
Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons why I've, been a little cautious about trying to do too much with COVID-19. I mean, I'm sure some people would like if I did a really long, blog post on it. But, I do feel like to a certain extent, there's so much uncertainty now that I don't want to try to throw too much out there, indicating to people this is really how it is type thing. Mm. So, I try to fall back on my own research into conspiracy theories. And I think this is, just one of the reasons why I've always been at an advantage over a lot of researchers in this type of thing, because I'm always very interested in where, conspiracies originated from and who, started disseminating them, and then trying to ascertain why they might have done this and so on and so forth. So, that was kind of something that I would originally apply to this. Okay, so what are some of the tropes that are being brought out now? Well, I mean, again, you're seeing a lot of the, the UN type stuff being rolled out, but I mean, that's always, in my opinion, something that you have to be very cautious about. I mean, I know I just did an interview, I think it was about a week ago, where the guy was telling me that it was being set up for the World Health Organization to achieve unprecedented power, and that was going to kind of be the nucleus for, a one-world UN-backed government. And then I think it was just a day or two, I woke up to see a headline about Trump threatening the United Nations or the World Health Organization with funding. And by the end of the day, it was like a whole coalition of countries, Japan and so on and so forth. So, there is, I think, a lot of that playing out. And I mean, you and I have talked about a lot before, I tend to take more of a factional view of the broader hierarchy, or maybe I would say maybe more accurately, I tend to view the ruling elite as somewhat akin to the syndicate, the, National Organized Crime Syndicate that oversaw the mob in the country for many years, probably still exists in some form or other. So you've got all of these, different mafia families sitting there at the table, and they have general, coordinating interests they're trying to carry out and so on and so forth. But they're all, totally ruthless and immoral in the same hand. So they're also continuously looking ways to get kind of leg up on their rival. And for a lot of years, they were able to keep things up to, an acceptable level of rivalry. But really, I mean, going into the late 70s, early 80s, I mean, things just really got out of hand. Probably one of the more infamous was the Philadelphia Mafia War that unfolded really from the late 70s, early 80s. And, you had dozens of people being killed and some, just really high profile assassinations. There was, what was his name? Nicky Scarfo, the Chicken Man. His death was actually immortalized in the opening lines of the Bruce Springsteen song, Atlantic City. They blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night. They blew up his house too. Yes. I mean, essentially he was blown up in his front door in the morning in a suburb. I think it was a nail bomb to boot, but, and that was the whole thing, the mob, people are okay with, legalized gambling or even quasi-illegal gambling and so forth, because everybody likes to wage bets and that type of thing. You can get away with stuff like that. But you start blowing up a don in the middle of a suburb, that's the kind of thing that crosses a line for a lot of people. And it really, I think, led to the downfall of the power of the syndicate in a lot of levels. I mean, certainly they've been massively surpassed by the quote-unquote Russian mafia and a lot of other crime syndicates. And I just think a lot of that really went back to the 80s. Eventually, the violence just spiraled out of control. The families were not able to, bring back the order and discipline that had really prevailed for much of the Cold War. And it led to a lot of people being indicted. A lot of the major families were laid low, and they've never really regained the influence that they had circa 1980. And to some extent, I think something like that is playing out with the global elite now. I mean, I know Chris Knowles has speculated about this, that the catalyst was the death of David Rockefeller in 2017. That certainly is a good possibility. I mean, I do think the Rockefeller's influence has been declining for years already, but I mean, with him gone, there's no other member of the family that has anywhere near the kind of prestige that David did to kind of fill the vacuum. I mean, I don't know, maybe Kissinger's trying to do it a little bit, but there just isn't really, you know, that kind of hand coordinating everything that there was. And I think that's definitely led to a bit of a free for all now. And certainly, you know, you kind of wonder, well, is this COVID-19 thing the equivalent of the Philadelphia mob war? Was it something that kind of started as a minor dispute over, you know, who's getting concessions in Atlantic City that's eventually, you know, spiraled and out of control in some ways?
door, walking out the door. Oh God, I hate you.
All right, so there's an awful lot of threads there, and I'm inclined to try and bring it, well, as happens in our conversations previously, to some ground we can really stand on, which would be this unified principle that while there may not, and I would agree with you, even though it's well, it's something that I'm trying to be more open to, because I have a tendency to see something as unified occurring in the planet, and I have had for a long time this sense of a kind of unified intent or design behind the way that the world is going. And so there's been a tendency to project that onto individuals and groups as if they were all working together and colluding in a David Icke-ian sense, you know, the hidden reptilian presence. And needless to say, I hope I consider that far too much of a literalization. So you and I, we've talked about what's going on in with the metaphor, fittingly, in fact, before COVID-19 blew up, of a virus, as in something that's replicating itself and propagating itself through different individuals and through different groups, and that unifies them in a way that they themselves wouldn't necessarily experience it as unification. And if so, I mean, if there's anything in this model, then to me, one of the most compelling evidence for it is this, that all of these different groups and individuals seem to adhere to similar, if not identical, methodologies, which is back to this, the use of violence, terror, and traumatization as a way to impose control, starting, you know, with children. So that, although, as I say, that doesn't make them unified, just because different groups and individuals have the same methods doesn't mean they've got, and even if they have the same goals, doesn't mean to say they're on the same team, of course, because there's rivalry. But it could mean that they were, kind of ironically, tragically, they would be working towards the same end, even if they were opposed, because they're using the same basic methods and they have the same basic goal.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, that's a possibility. And I mean, you know, I think the first time we kind of went over this, you know, we had speculated possibly that there was some kind of, you know, non-human intelligence guiding it, which I personally think would be the most plausible explanation for a unified principle, so to speak, behind this. Because it just seems like, you know, the individual players and how a lot of this stuff plays out is so chaotic. But I mean, in a sense, though, I do think above it, though, there might be something that's stealthily guiding this to some end or another, though obviously I don't even know if the human mind is really capable, honestly, of determining what it's being guided towards. But yeah, I mean, and then I suppose you could also, I mean, look in some senses to the kind of are you familiar with Babylon 5, actually?
Only by name, and in fact, I've written about the author of that, Michael.
Oh yes,
Stravinsky,
yes.
That's he's in Maps of Hell. Yeah,
it's really a brilliant, brilliant show. But essentially, okay, you've got the major races who are sort of a stand-in for the, you know, the United Earth, for the Earth, essentially, and the different cultures in the United Nation. The Earthers in Bay 5 are the stand-in for the United States. The Centauri are the British Empire. The Narn are the Islamic world. The Minbari are probably the Japanese and the Chinese and so forth. But, you know, as the show goes on, you kind of find out that at the dawn of the universe, there were these two ancient races. One was the Vorlon, and the other was the Shadows. And these two races are so advanced that they, you know, are effectively godlike to any of the other species. And as the show unfolds, you come to find out that, you know, they have essentially been worshipped as gods all across the galaxy in these various cultures. I mean, the Vorlon specifically, when they appear outside of their encounter suits, I mean, they look like angelic beings from, you know, any number of different cultures and so forth. And essentially they've been engaged in the Four Lines and the Shadows in this kind of Manchean struggle for just millions and millions of years. And through this struggle, they've been manipulating their different followers and their factions and so forth. And, of course, the Vorlon have tried to kind of portray themselves as being the good guys, so to speak, because they're the Lords of Order. But, I mean, as the show kind of advances, we see that, you know, they have no problem trying to incite a species to, you know, effectively sacrifice itself in a mass genocide for the greater good and so forth. So, you know, I'm also kind of wondering it sometimes, too, is it possible that there is this kind of, you know, Vorlon slash shadow duality that is kind of playing out behind the scenes and all of this, and it's some kind of struggle that maybe even the two forces behind it have even forgotten what the purpose of it was because it's been going on for so long, and you've got their different minions on the Earth that, I mean, have been, you know, enlisted into all of this. They've been brainwashed into thinking that, you know, I mean, these are divine beings or whatever, that they have a pure and noble agenda, and it's really no such thing. They, as I said before, they don't even really know what they're fighting about any longer and probably haven't known for a very long time.
Amnesiacs. Well, you know, they say nature abhors a vacuum, and I think this applies especially even to the human mind. It's very hard, again, to be liminal and to see so much evidence and so much of effects of things going on that are incomprehensible and just leave to stay in a state of unknowing. And so something usually fills that vacuum. And of course, Christianity, I imagine many Christians feel quite comfortable in a certain sense and quite secure in the certainty that they know what's going on, that there's a battle in heaven, and that whether it's the Nephilim or the fallen Elohim or Lucifer, you know, it doesn't really matter. It would depend on their level of education or indoctrination. They may well feel quite secure in understanding, you know, the situation. It's this is Satan's realm, and the fallen angels have taken control over humanity, and so on and so forth. Right? That doesn't really wash for me, and I imagine for you, not in the sense that I think it's untrue, but I mean it's just not sufficiently nuanced. And ditto with Ike and his reptilians. I mean, there's probably millions of people now who aren't Christian, who've been New Age indoctrinated, to also feel they more or less know what's going on, but instead of fallen angels, they have extraterrestrials. Now, I know that you were saying something similar, and you and I maybe are in a similar position there in the sense of acknowledging that, well, something this bizarre and inexplicable probably does have an equally bizarre and incomprehensible explanation, so why not go to Babylon 5 or the Bible? But at the same time, I think neither of us are really committed to that. We're not blogging about it, writing about it, in my case, because I recognize that this really is incomprehensible to the human mind. So if I start to try and wrestle it to the ground, you know, mentally, cognitively, I know I'm going to come a cropper.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, on top of that, too, I mean, I kind of think that humans innately look for patterns and a unifying principle behind everything as well, which, you know, I kind of think is a danger when you do get into this analysis of this, because, you know, obviously there are patterns in some of this stuff, but I do think that, you know, especially when you get into a lot of the conspiracy circles and what have you, I mean, people become so obsessed with applying and finding patterns everywhere that it's just become, you know, it's deteriorated into gibberish, essentially. You're trying to apply order to something where, you know, probably the powers that be behind it would have never even thought that there would be order there. You know what I mean?
I do. I was approaching that thesis with Kubrick as an example of him putting just a few clues in his films that there were clues there, and then the audience themselves would find a million things that he never intentionally put there and do the work for him. So I think there's something in that. I think that is a principle of social engineering. And I think it goes back to the demons, actually, again. I mean, the alleged demons are something that C.S. Lewis said about the demons, is if they can't get people to disbelieve in them and ignore them completely, they get people to obsess over them and capture their attention. And I do feel more and more, it's more and more apparent to me that conspiracy theory has this demonic aspect to it, that it attracts those who are oppressed by other people's denial of what's going on to become overly obsessed with what they think is going on.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in the sense, you know, I was kind of talking about earlier, I mean, it's almost literal when you're looking at the, you know, the American Security Council and a guy like, you know, Aquino being involved in that. I mean, you know, it's quite possible Aquino himself, I mean, if you would pick somebody who would be a demon-possessed individual, I'm sure he would probably be a high on a lot of people's lists, but,
He dressed the part, so it made it seem as like a double bluff. You know? If you think I'm evil, you really are an idiot, kind of.
Yeah, and I've always kind of said that, you know, there's definitely, you know, I mean, Aquino is almost a comic book villain in a lot of ways. I mean, there is, you know, different nuances to what he's trying to do. But certainly, I do think one of his major duties over the years has just been to utterly destroy a lot of conspiracy communities and so forth. I mean, obviously, he's usually much more equated with UFO circles and what have you. But I would imagine, you know, he's probably also been involved in a lot of these, you know, kind of conspiratorial right circles as well, especially, again, going back to his association with the ASC in the 1980s. So, and I mean, that's just something that especially I don't think a lot of people in these communities really want to address, you know, is the fact that so many of these theories were disseminated by U.S. intelligence officers in the case of Aquino, also, you know, an occultist as well, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it really is quite a hall of mirrors. And, you know, I think it's even worse sometimes when you get into a lot of the UFO circles, because for a lot of people, I mean, this is also a spiritual question as well as just a parapolitical one. And they're even less inclined to, you know, want to address, you know, something like the unsettling legacy of neo-Nazism and fascism and a lot of the early UFO communities through people like George Hunt Williamson and that type of thing. So, yes, I mean, there is a lot of sinister forces, so to speak, lurking behind a lot of these, you know, conspiracy theories in the first place, which, yeah, I mean, most people don't even want to address that.
Well, I'm wondering, again, you know, to try and bring it down to the individual level so that we can relate to it directly, even the human body and the human psyche, to what extent I don't know if you've thought about this. I haven't much, but I have written about it, so I must have thought about it because it's come out through my books, but consciously articulated it maybe until now. But the way in which we respond to trauma can also have this sort of demonic finger trap in it, because many people who are victims of trauma, and I would say that includes us all, but to different degrees of awareness, it's possible, and it's quite common, I think, that a person will become obsessed with the trauma, whether they remember it or not, and also potentially obsessed with the perpetrator, and that in itself is a kind of imprisonment, because they're constantly reliving. It's like fingering a wound, isn't it? Constantly reliving something that happened to them or that they think happened to them. They're constantly trying to resolve it in the wrong ways by exposing or attacking or confronting. I mean, sometimes this could work if it's a family member, but, you know, the supposed agent of abuse, when really the problem perhaps, and this could bring us to the larger subject or the deeper subject of the fascia and what I call the mass psychology of the fascia, you know, how we've been, our system's gone into lockdown due to abuse, rather than going into that and just releasing the trauma through changing one's relationship to the body in the present, we're constantly trying to resolve it with these paper tigers, which are the movies, the horror movies playing in our heads from the trauma that's imprinted. And so I'm mentioning it now because that's something that maybe many of us do have an individual personal sense of. But could that be extended outward to this whole global planetary preoccupation with organized ritual abuse and conspiracies and controlling forces and fallen angels and all the rest of it? That we're just constantly kind of replaying some original trauma in a way that perpetuates it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. And I mean, it is really interesting with all of the mass, you know, self-isolation that's going on. right now, because I mean, you know, and I've even seen this from some of my coworkers. I mean, I think it's already really having a, you know, a very tremendous effect on people. And I just think a lot of people are just so, you know, underdeveloped on an individual level. There's really just not a lot to their lives other than, you know, going to work and going out clubbing and that type of thing. And now that they can't really do that, they're stuck at home. They've played, you know, as many of the video games as they possibly could. They binged all of the Netflix shows that they possibly could. And now there's nothing left really but self-introspection. And, you know, that's leading people, I think, to what you're kind of saying. They're starting to play out all of these different traumas and so forth, some of which are all, you know, related to alienation on some level or another. And now we've almost all become socially alienated from one another with the quarantine orders and the masks and the gloves and all of this stuff. You know, I mean, human contact really, I just think, is a fundamental part of happiness. And I mean, we're being denied that. And I think it's really triggering a lot of trauma in people now that they have to deal with this introspection. There's no way to bury it in work or substance. Well, I mean, suppose to some extent with substance abuse, but not to the extent that they could, though, I think, with, you know, the kind of club scene still going and what have you. And yeah, I mean, I think I just read that the suicide rate in Tennessee this past week had actually been higher than the deaths related to COVID-19. And I certainly wouldn't be surprised if we see more and more of that in the coming weeks.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's likely also that, I mean, because when you say, you know, self-introspection is the only thing left, that does seem like a light at the end of the tunnel, potentially, because, I mean, self-introspection can allow something to come into awareness that is genuinely liberating. But on the other hand, it seems likely that in many of these cases, you say, if there's too strong an adverse reaction to the toxins that start coming up, because we could also bring it to a physiological level, that trauma, you know, because it imprints the body and changes the posture and whatnot and the breathing and all these other things in such a way that we're constantly creating toxins in our own body, then the resistance to self-introspection would grow the harder it was getting to avoid it. So then you can also see people doubling down. You say, well, they run out of things to binge on. They wouldn't care. They'd just binge again, right? Just watch the same shows again, take more drugs, and so on. So I could see it's like a dam, really. You know, the more pressure gets, the more they keep building up something to prevent it coming through.
Well, absolutely. And it's like you're saying, I mean, self-introspection can, in a lot of ways, be a wonderful thing. But it's like, you know, I think with a lot of things, though, you have to have a roadmap for it, though, or some concept of how you're going to get from point A or point B. Because if you don't, you know, it's something that you can just completely drown in. And like you're saying, instead of, you know, finding the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, you're just going to fall back on trying to completely numbing yourself with, you know, alcohol or drugs or something like that, or just watching, you know, I mean, the upteenth violent horror film over and over again, or pretending to be a Blackwater mercenary or something in Call of Duty. And yeah, I mean, like you said, this is just kind of reinforcing the trauma. It's not, you know, resolving it in any way. And then, you know, now on top of everything else, you're really cut out from the human companionship, which I think is really a stabilizing force for a lot of people in this day and age.
Yeah, that's right. I think most of us, it's very difficult to go into that inner distress if we don't have a safe space to do it in. And of course, being alone could be a safe space. Traditionally, you go up to the cave and whatnot. But being surrounded by technology and drugs is not the equivalent, needless to say. So I think probably the only way for many of us is to find that network of human community, people working together on that to support each other energetically so that that can happen. And it does seem as though it's going in the opposite direction currently.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. You know, and I've already seen this for years because, I mean, you know, I've never really had issues with being alone myself. Of course, I'm an only child, so I'm sure that probably helps a lot. Spend a good amount of time by myself as a young one. So, you know, it's something I'm used to, but I just, you know, I know a lot of my friends, especially those who, you know, have had to deal with traumas. I mean, I'm thinking of one person in particular who's been raped on two separate occasions, and she's always had a lot of problems when she's cut off from her kind of circle of friends and the community and so on and so forth. And, you know, now you're effectively in a quarantine where it's like, you know, it's not just a matter of distance or scheduling with work or anything. It's a matter that you can't even legally go and see, you know, the people that you draw strength from, even if you wanted to or were able to. And, yeah, I mean, I just think that's really going to have a horrendous effect on people going forward, and it's only going to reinforce, if not expound upon, all of these other bad habits. And in a lot of ways, I mean, that's kind of the curse of social media. You know, you can't even be truly alone. You're kind of still subjected to all of this stuff, so that you can't even completely disconnect consciously.
Unless
you know, you really deliberately do it on your own, you know.
And that's back to what you were talking about initially about the propaganda as a form of terrorization, isn't it? Because people are just constantly being stimulated with information or mis or disinformation that's triggering their, you know, their fight or flight responses.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's just being reinforced, because now, you know, you're looking at your Facebook feed and this is pretty much all everybody's talking about in your feed. So, I mean, even if you're consciously trying to avoid this traumatic type of propaganda, there it is. You know, you've got to go into it if you even want to, you know, interact with other human beings in a lot of cases. So, yeah, it's really quite Machiavellian in a sense, in that they've almost made it to where, you know, you can't escape it anymore. You know, we're all being bombarded with it on a, you know, massive scale. I mean, I suppose there was something in the States like this akin to, you know, with 9/11, but, you know, even then, I think the trauma from 9/11 wore off for a lot of people within a week or two, whereas, you know, with this, you can't go out, you know, there's almost no way that you can get away from it. And, yeah, I mean, how are people going to react after a month, 2 months of this insanity? It's,
yeah, well,
it's not going to be pretty.
I think there's more kind of lived consequences even already from what I've heard than 9/11. I mean, unless you count obviously family relatives of the people who died in that event. But in terms of people losing friendships and connections to family members and presumably marriages that are breaking apart, if not ending in murder and so on, I mean, that would be for a different reason. If you're locked down together, that obviously is going to increase the pressure in ways that are unnatural and potentially catastrophic. But, I mean, specifically the divide and conquer thing of this information overload, including fake news on both sides, right? For however many phases of these narratives that people are being bombarded.
You know, and the looming economic pressure, too.
Yeah,
I mean, that's another thing. You know, how are we going to pay the bills next week? I mean...
Yeah. Well, I want to try and get to the solution, or at least to talk around it. So I've got somewhere I want to start. I mean, it's a continuation of what we just said, but hopefully I can keep it reasonably condensed. But we're talking about trauma and how to resolve it. And what we were touching on there together, I think, was that what I see anyway is the difference between unconsciously reenacting a trauma and actually... re-experiencing the original trauma in such a way that it clears out of the body. And so you're talking about, well, people who are there in lockdown, potentially they can go into self-reflection and they just sit there, right? If they just sat there with no drugs and no distractions, they'd start to feel all that anxiety that they've been pushing down for all those decades. Potentially there could be something cathartic and beyond cathartic, like a letting go. But what happens generally is they just keep reenacting the trauma through the video games, through the drug taking, the self-destructive behaviors, through the Netflix binging, most of which is violent entertainment and so on. So what I'm wondering is to talk to you about here as a fellow researcher, is that, because you were saying people don't have the tools, it was interesting to me that you're saying that they don't have the tools or the map by which to go into that trauma and find release and relaxation. And so I'm wondering, and I was before this conversation, to what extent can what we do, which is mapping the trauma, the global trauma, including you know, conspiracies and social engineering and regimes of torture and really dark stuff, you know, which for some people, as I was pointing out, is a demonic kind of entertainment. It's a real razor's edge. But is there a way to present that information in such a way that it helps people, it gives people a map by which they can go into their trauma rather than avoid it? Because it's closer than, I mean, you've got conspiratainment. This is the downside, that facts can be rearranged in such a way that it is disinformation and it's entertainment and it's just feeding a sort of demonic obsession, right? But it can also be presented, or can it, is my question, can it also be presented in such a way that it allows people to put their awareness on that locked up fascia in the body that has been caused by all of these global events over the centuries, without obsessing on the story itself, but using it as a map so that they become more conscious of what's happened to them and psychically, psychologically, and physiologically, and so it's an orientation. They become more orientated to what's happening, they deepen their understanding of it, and so then they can start to turn away. This is what I've been trying to do, take their attention away from the world, which maybe is always going to be this trauma generated hell realm, who knows, and onto the body where the trauma is, and start breathing more deeply, you know, and just being in their body and appreciating nature and moving gradually into their bodies and into a way of living. Seems to me that they can work together. It's not just about don't think about what's going on and don't, right? There's a way to actually pass the information and contextualize it, and that it can be applied for deepening understanding and for a kind of self surgery by which we extricate the traumatic imprint from our souls and our bodies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, that's, you know, kind of what partly inspired me to write the Mellon essay in the first place, is I wanted to map out, you know, really the origins of a lot of these common conspiracy tropes on the right, and, you know, make people aware of the fact that, I mean, a lot of this is disinformation, and the fact that, you know, it is designed to be a traumatic type of disinformation, and that, you know, if you're going into the type of stuff without being aware of that, you know, it's going to eat you up and chew you up and spit you out, essentially. You know, sometimes it's better just to avoid it altogether, or, you know, when you are getting into it, you have to take a detached perspective of it and realize, you know, that this is just one side of the coin, essentially. But I mean, more than anything, I just think, you know, you need to, especially now, you know, people just need to find something that's constructive and, you know, self-fulfilling. And, you know, this can be something that you can do with your families. It can be something you can do as an individual. You know, just to kind of give you an example, and something that I think we've lost a lot as a society over the years, but, you know, which we really have a great potential to bring back now, was musicianship, essentially. You know, you go back and you look at the standard American family around 1900 or so, almost everybody could play an instrument of some kind, piano, maybe a little guitar or something like that. They could all sing to some extent or another. And a lot of times when families wanted to entertain themselves in the evenings, they would all get together and they would sit down and they would play music together. They would play songs together. People would do their instruments. They would sing. And this was a very, you know, I think this was really a great thing for a lot of people. It fulfilled artistic aspirations. It gave you a sense of bonding with your loved ones and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that's just been totally lost in the electronic technological era. I mean, why would you sit down and try to pick a song with your parents when, you know, you could just listen to something on, you know, your Amazon Unlimited streaming or something like that? But I mean, you know, it's kind of like missing the point. It's the togetherness. It's, you know, fulfilling an artistic aspiration, and it's doing something positive. Sure. You know, I know a lot of people, you know, musicians over the years, and you know, I mean, almost everybody has always talked about how just a wonderful feeling it is when you're playing together, when you're in sync in each other, because you're bonding in a way that it really transcends, you know, self-aware consciousness. It goes into an almost unconscious level of bonding. It's really amazing. And, you know, this is the type of thing, you know, you've got the golden opportunity to do it now. Try it out.
Right.
It's a way that, you know, you can step out of this just poisonous, you know, mainstream culture that we've been talking about and do something that's fulfilling. Or, you know, on top of that, why not try creating your own art? I mean, I've always kind of been weary of the whole, you know, advice of just, you know, well, stop watching Netflix or stop watching movies and what have you. I think that's, in a lot of ways, it's as practical as telling people to just become an atheist. I think, you know, spirituality is hardwired in, you know, human beings innately, and I think the same thing applies to storytelling. You know, it's how we've really, both of which are really how we've related to the world for eons, you know. I mean, we want to hear stories. That's just a part of being a human. So instead of just, you know, watching these traumatic storylines on Netflix over and over again, write your own. I mean, that's actually something that my wife has been doing, which I'm very proud of her. She's almost finished her first novel. In fact, she'll probably be done a week or so. And, you know, it's a fantasy novel. It has a build up to an epic battle like so many of these kinds of stories do, but instead they actually sit down and talk their differences out and come up with a peaceful way to resolve a conflict without killing and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of her, and I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of constructive thing I'm getting at. You know, change the narrative, fulfill an artistic aspiration. Do something, though, that's also going to step out of this cycle of abuse. You know, I mean, really, in a lot of ways, we've all got a great opportunity to embrace these kinds of things now. And certainly, I think that would be much more enlightening, and it would put you much more on a path towards self-introspection, a positive kind of self-introspection, than just, you know, sitting around and getting high or, you know, playing PlayStation for the upteenth time.
I know from personal experience that God is sowing seeds of folly and reaping a whirlwind of suffering and shame. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever.
Do you consider your work to be storytelling of its kind also?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I would consider myself to be a historian first and foremost, but, I mean, history is ultimately defined by a cast of characters and so on and so forth. And, that's actually something very much with the Epstein book that I'm currently working on that was on my mind a lot. Who are really the main characters in this? And the more I looked at it, it kind of became more evident to me. Well, in a lot of ways, this is, at least the first book in the Epstein book series, is going to be the story of Julian Amery and a lot of the members of Clan Frazier of Lovett, because I think they were really the guys who were driving a lot of the action that's going to unfold in this work. It was really a revelation for me, because I'd never really, thought of my work that way, but I was like, this is really Amory's story as much as anything, and I have to try to make the reader identify with him the way that they would a character in a novel or something like that, and try to understand, where he's coming from when I get into the speculative parts at the end to try to explain why he would do these actions and so on and so forth.
What's his motivation? I've had a very hard time trying to write fiction. I have written some, but so actual overt literal storytelling in the sense of inventing doesn't come that easily to me. And when I've tried to turn my own life into fiction, it's been hellish. It's been really, it's turned out to be impossible. And the reason why is that I know too much, I guess, I can do it on a micro level. I'm doing it with this latest blog post, and I've been doing it with blog posts, and I did it with Seen and Not Seen. But in terms of actually turning my life into a story, it's impossible. Where I see the correlation here anyway between writing stories and kind of research that you and I do is that, and I think we have similar methods. Not the same, of course, but that to me, and it's ironic because it's actually quite close to the conspiracy theorist who's joining dots. It's very close. It's almost indistinguishable. But what I try to do is find key points, key areas of evidence, or key clues, and juxtapose them in such a way that a story emerges, and I feel like I'm discovering a story that I didn't realize was there, rather than imposing one on it. Now, of course, I can't say that I'm not imposing in some way, because I'm selecting the evidence. But I'm trying not to join the dots, as in, invent that connective tissue that will make it a story obvious to the reader, and leave those spaces there for the reader to add that connective tissue or not. And I think I've been effective to the extent that I know some people read Prisoner Infinity and they don't see that as about a grand conspiracy, whereas others see it as absolute confirmation of what they think is a grand conspiracy, and so on. So that seems to confirm, that's working.
No, it's, you really did a great job with Prisoner of Infinity, because, obviously it works well, as kind of a scholarly account of the Fabians and so forth. Vice of Kings, I actually was thinking the one, because I've only read a little bit of Prisoner, but Vice, though, it's kind of this overreaching theme with the Fabians, but, in a lot of ways, it's also your own personal journey and a discovery of journey of self-discovery for you as well, which you also convey. And that. I really liked how you kind of juxtaposed your own, kind of struggle with, this kind of broader overreaching historical theme that you were trying to address in that work.
Well, thanks. And it was, I think I made it apparent that it was a really attempt, maybe slightly desperate even, to bring coherence to my own life. And I do think that, why we're so drawn to stories is similar to that. Like we sense there is an inherent coherence to existence, and it's there in nature and our own bodies, the way things are configured, they're coherently arranged, right? So the heart is part of the story, and the brain and the liver, they're all protagonists in this incredible story that's unfolding in life itself. It doesn't have a beginning or a middle or an end, but as insofar as we've lost a connection to that you know, in hate or implicate coherence, I think we're perhaps more compulsively drawn to stories because they give us a sense of order. And that can be escapism, and it can be definitely counterproductive or whatever. It can just feed into delusions and, you know, just be a kind of running over of old traumas. But I think it can also, it's like where the poison is, seek the cure. It can also resolve something by rediscovering the guiding intelligence within us that does make life coherent. And in a certain sense, it does narrate, but not like the mind narrates, but it arranges and it responds to different elements in our lives and sees the interconnections between them. And then there's the aha moment. Aha, okay, so now I know what I was doing there. Now, right? And then something changes when we see that we were behaving unconsciously, we become conscious of why, then we're acting consciously. That seems to me that's a curve, you know, a learning curve by which we become more conscious. And I do think it's compatible with what we're doing, as in trying to become more conscious of the nature of the world.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in my case, usually when I'm trying to, you know, figure out like what conspiracy I want to write about or something to that effect, I mean, usually it's determined by, you know, whether I can see something in a, you know, a particular subject that is, you know, generally been downplayed or something to that effect. And then I will look at it and I'll kind of think like, well, okay, what is the story behind this? You know, why is it not held up as being significant as some of the other aspects of this particular scandal or something to that effect? And then how does it relate to the more well-known elements of it? And usually when I find something that's really compelling like that, then a kind of narrative emerges in my mind, like, okay, well, this is actually a really significant part of this, you know, broader conspiracy, and now I have a narrative, something that's going to put the overall conspiracy in a completely different perspective for a lot of people when they see this element that's been underplayed before.
Right. It's the anomaly, isn't it? It's the thing that's missing or that's been de-emphasized. It's exactly the same with Whitley Strieber, how Prisoner Infinity came about. Was, wait a minute, there are things here that really stand out, but they're being completely ignored. That's where I want to look. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
It turns out that's where the story is. And it's occurring to me that there's kind of one could make an analogy there with the human body. Like, there are areas of numbness, for example, or knots, and that potentially, that's where our awareness needs to go, but it's often where our awareness doesn't go. Like, if it's numb, then obviously we're not feeling anything there, or if there's a lot of tension, we just avoid it because we don't want to feel the pain, right? So it seems to me it's similar to that. Trying to find coherence is also in a story, or a narrative is also like trying to make the body fully conscious by going into all the different areas that we've neglected and ignored.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that's why there has been such a, you know, a keen interest now in alternative, you know, health, alternative medicine and that type of thing. Because, I mean, you know, you do have the kind of conventional narrative that's put out, you know, by big pharma and mainstream science and, you know, medical professionals and so forth. And, you know, it's ultimately led to a massive amount of neglect in the broader health of the body. And I mean, certainly, I think from just, you know, a psychological perspective, how that affects you physically and that type of thing. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's definitely led to a lot of undiscovered areas and so forth.
So I did want to get to this fascia. I know I keep mentioning it, and it's not a word I was familiar with until recently, but now it's just become very meaningful to me. And I thought maybe we could riff a bit or brain whatever, just improvise and see if anything comes up around this. That we've got this global lockdown going on, and we don't need to say much more about that, but it seems to me that it corresponds with this internal lockdown that we're unconscious of, which is the nervous system has gone into lockdown due to repeat early traumas. And our reaction to that, like the nervous system contracts, the fascia congeals or coagulates, I don't know what the right word for it would be, but it gets frozen. And so our physiology, our nervous system and our bodies become locked into a particular shape, you might say. And that, it seems to me, that's where the problem is. Like, we could look at the world and we could see this, like now, there's a global agenda to whatever it is, but that's locking us down as a society and an economy. There's not much we can do about that. But if it reflects something that's internal, then it's possible to use that as a mirror, as something that's pointing at something that we can do something about, which is our internal lockdown system, you know, where it's, what happened to our nervous system? We don't even notice it, right, really, many of us. I mean, we do, of course, because we're miserable, but we're not really aware that we haven't relaxed in our whole lives, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, now that, you know, you really have an indefinite amount of time to relax, I mean, people just basically find themselves to be completely unable to, which I think is really a testament to how far the conditioning has gone at this point.
Right, right. Without the drugs and the distraction and the entertainment, which, mm-hmm. I mean, as you say, one doesn't want to take a hardline position. It is relaxing. I mean, the drugs I do take a hard line on, but the Netflix not so much, right? I draw a line about what I do to my body, and maybe that's an arbitrary line, because as I've researched in Maps of Hell, when we watch entertainment, we are generating, you know, chemical responses in the body. But anyway, I draw the line at actually what I literally put in the body, drugs and food, and what just through my senses. And I do, yeah, I get a lot of relaxation out of watching, and it feels really healthy and helpful to me. But in terms of diet and, you know, clean living, that seems to be really essential to me to observe that, and spending as much time in nature. Well, 'cause that's something that's being taken away from people if they're literally not allowed to leave their houses or allowed to go out to exercise, aren't they? But anyway, that's being severely limited. Do you have a sense? I mean, does this, in your thesis in the book, I know that you don't go into it in the book, but is it something you've considered in terms of the lasting effects of trauma and how it potentially it reconfigures our physiology, it physically changes us, but also how it creates a consciousness, how it shapes our consciousness and even creates a kind of identity, a trauma-based identity that we then are trapped in?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, kind of with some of the research, especially with the Epstein book, I've, you know, started to wonder if this is why there's such an authoritarian, a reoccurring authoritarian personalities in so many elites. And, you know, specifically when you look at, you know, British society and how the, you know, elites were typically raised, a lot of this revolved around going to the quote-unquote public schools. I think they're now finally calling them private schools or something, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, essentially these were elite institutions where the sons and daughters, or usually it was the sons of the aristocracy, went to and so forth. And obviously there's been a lot of indications for years that sexual abuse is just rampant at these public schools. Of course, Crowley, you know, wrote about being sexually assaulted, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly, John Peel did. Julian Emery's brother, John Emery, who has quite an interesting story, also experienced pretty traumatic sexual abuse at some of the public schools and so forth.
Richard Dawkins is another.
Yes.
Stephen Fry. Yeah, the list is endless. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've only really gotten hints about it, but certainly just from the little I've seen, it seems like a lot of this sexual abuse was epidemic. Some of it was committed by other students. Sometimes it's committed by teachers. It just depends, but it's been horrendous. And I mean, it's been going on since at least the 19th century. It would hardly surprise me if it was even, you know, much longer than that. But, you know, it can be at least reliably chronicled back to roughly the late 19th century. And, you know, you look at what was going on at the British Empire at the time. I mean, it was the definitive empire in the world, and it was also just an absolutely brutal one. I mean, this was around the time that you had the Boer War, for instance, which was the first large-scale use of genocide in the 20th century. So, and it has kind of occurred to me, well, how much of this whole mindset was a result of what these, you know, these aristocrats went through as children in these public schools. You know, they were also very much oriented around competitiveness and sports and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the kids were constantly put into competition with each other. And again, my understanding is, I mean, the competitions with the sports could be quite brutal. There was a lot of hazing and so on and so forth. And you throw that on top of all the sexual abuse. And it certainly seems to me that a lot of them did have to craft a protective shell to make it, you know, to make their way through all of this as children. But I mean, the problem with that is I think that, you know, as adults, this really resulted in an extreme lack of empathy for their fellow human beings, because they themselves had suffered so much in many ways for rather ridiculous reasons. And now, you know, it creates a broader mindset of, you know, when you're managing global affairs and so on and so forth, well, I mean, what does it really matter if a lot of your populace is impoverished or working in dangerous jobs and so on and so forth? I mean, that's just the way it is. And the, you know, strong will rise to the top and the weak should fall to the bottom, as is their nature. You know, I mean, this is really a mindset that I do think had its origins in these schools, and it was later drilled into the elites, and they would, you know, implant this kind of broader ideology on society as a whole. And with the vast scale of the British Empire, it wasn't just restricted to the UK. It was imported to, you know, all across the entire world. So you can just kind of see in this one particular case of how the trauma that was experienced in these public schools led to an authoritarian personality in many of these ruling elites, and how this was later spread throughout the world, and really in quite a horrendous fashion to boot. You know, it's really quite tragic on any number of levels.
Did you see the show Patrick Melrose with Cumberbatch, Benedict, whatever his name is? I never remember.
Yeah, the guy on Sherlock Holmes. No, I have not seen that.
Based on British novels by Teddy St. Albin, who was a heroin addict, and he was upper class. Anyway, or he is, I think he's still alive. Anyway, it's there's a scene in the childhood sequences. As a child, his father's played by Hugo Weaving, Agent Smith, and this scene has recurred in another show I watched more recently. I can't remember which one now, but I've seen it twice now, variations of it, in which the father has the child hold on to his forearms, and while he's holding on to the child's ears, so that there's no pressure on the ears because the child's holding on to the forearms, and then he tells the child, "Trust me, let go." And the child doesn't want to, but he says, "Just trust me, let go." And the child finally lets go, and the father holds on to the ears, and the child starts screaming. And then he drops him, and then he says, "Never ever trust anyone." And it was the same scene in this other show as well. Like, this was like, it seemed to me this is revelation of a method thing, of the lesson that the aristocracy learned to teach to their children.
Yeah, I could certainly see a lot of variations on that being played out in some of these families. And, well, I mean, I know it was like, what was it, the Rockefeller family. I think that the first John D. Rockefeller, if I'm not mistaken, had made his kids wear the hand-down clothes because he was essentially too cheap to buy them their own clothes. And in some cases, the boys would end up wearing, the clothes from their older sisters and what have you. So, I mean, basically he was forcing them to cross dress because this, you know, millionaire just, you know, wanted to instill frugality in his kids, you know. Yeah. And I mean, certainly in this era, the 19th century, I'm sure that probably was, it was not probably a pleasant experience for some of these kids to show up at these schools wearing women's clothing and so on and so forth. And it kind of just reminds me of the same, you know, mindset. Well, this is, you know, the value of saving money, so when you're an adult, you know, you don't have to wear your sister's hand-me-downs type thing. Or just general, you know, why, you should not have empathy for people or try to help them in any way. Because, I mean, you know, the trauma and the suffering from this is actually a wholesome life experience in some fashion.
Well, and think about, again, the nervous system. I mean, what either of those examples and any other number of other examples, all the way to all kinds of brutalization, as you say, the public schools. I mean, I went to public school, but I got off fairly easy as far as I know. I wasn't boarding school. But anyway, I mean, I know what goes on in those schools, of course. And parents generally know as well, I think, and at least the fathers do, because they went to those schools and that's why they send their kids. But yeah, like the more that stuff happens, the more a person goes into defense mode, goes into lockdown, you know, it's just constantly on edge, constantly feeling like they're going to be attacked at any moment, constantly defended. There's no way to relax. I imagine even if just one or two things like that happen young enough, that this is the nature of trauma, you know, because the nervous system is so open. I think this is one of the basic principles, isn't it? Like the younger the child, the more fully open their senses are, but they haven't formed, you know, a self-awareness yet even. So they're completely open in this kind of impersonal way or unformed, psychologically unformed way. Things are done to that child's body and the nervous system begins to reconfigure itself as a reaction against those traumas and go into this kind of lockdown mode of constant contraction. And then the identity forms out of that. It forms rather than just as a natural development of a healthy organism, it's an unnatural development of an unhealthy organism.
Interesting point too, earlier with the boarding schools, and often, I mean, the parents are specifically, the fathers are very well aware of like what they're subjecting their kids to when they send them off to this, and you know, that's kind of led to me a belief that in a lot of ways the elites are know, potentially even more obsessed with subjecting their kids to this kind of trauma than just normal. I mean, obviously, most normal parents really don't, you know, consciously want to subject their kids to this kind of abuse, whereas I do think there is a conscious desire to do it on the part of, you know, the aristocracy, the elites, you know, whatever you want to call them. And, I mean, I suppose probably some of it is just driven by trying to mold their sons into individuals that can continue on their empires as adults. You know, certainly that's been a major preoccupation of many of the elites in both the U.S. and the U.K. for a very long time. But yes, in trying to do this, though, I mean, certainly it creates a very warped kind of individual, to put it mildly, that survives all of this and is able to take on the mantle of the, you know, the joint stock company or whatever. And I mean, probably in a sense as well, it also makes it even more difficult to even relate to normal people, and even a certain degree of contempt on some level for, you know, individuals that didn't go through these kinds of traumatic experiences and so forth. You know, they didn't go through the proper molding to achieve, you know, the kind of success, you know, in the sense that they, you know, are currently experiencing. So, I mean, that's kind of an interesting perspective, is just how much the disdain, you know, amongst the elite for the poor and the downtrodden and so forth really derives from the fact that they didn't have to go through these traumas as kids the way that, I mean, the, you know, sons and daughters, and especially the sons of the aristocracy, often had to go through. They didn't pay their way, so to speak.
Combined with, as you said, the lack of empathy, I mean, the shutting down, because I think empathy is a physiological thing, more than the mental, more than the, well, they say there's affective empathy, and then there's cognitive empathy, and that sociopaths have plenty of the latter, because they need it to understand their prey, but they don't have any affective empathy, because that would mean that they wouldn't be able to abuse people, because they would feel it in their bodies.
Out of curiosity, what exactly is affective empathy defined as?
Well, affect is a psychological term for how we experience life when we're very young and we haven't formed a mental, mind-based identity. So we're just kind of receiving the world and perceiving the world directly through our senses. So, I mean, this is, I think, I would say, I mean, I'm free associating here or improvising, but this would relate to why many of us don't have early memories, because the way that we were processing experience and storing memories was very different than later on, when we sort of became living computers who would file them away like little movies. Initially, certainly as very young children, it's more synesthetic. They're just going straight into the body through all the senses simultaneously, and that's known as affect. So it's just, it's like a body imprint. So then affective empathy would be when we if somebody's in pain, or even if they talk about an experience that caused them pain, we experience it directly in our bodies rather than just conceptually.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yes, and I mean, I was also kind of thinking just in the terms of just physical touch and things as well, because, I mean, certainly, you know, when I put my arms around my wife, you know, I mean, there's just a feeling that I get from that that you just really couldn't express with words or anything like that, or really in a sense, too, sometimes when I'm with my cats as well. But, I mean, you know, pets are definitely great comforts, I mean, certainly. But, I mean, yeah, you know, there's just a certain sense that you can get that, you know, there just isn't a way to put it into words or something. And I think that's maybe what you're getting at with cognitive empathy, essentially. You know, you're aware of the concept of empathy and you can talk about it, but you're not actually capable of living it, so to speak.
Right, and you could, but you can also calculate. I mean, Ted Bundy say, I mean, who knows how true the stories around him were, but anyway, as a predator, he was very effective. He had charisma, of course, so he could charm people and put them at ease, but he also, they say, had this cognitive empathy, so he could deduce, maybe intuit is a word, I don't know, the way that a certain person would behave. He would know how to target people, and then how to, I mean, we see this in people who are successful in business and stuff. They know how to manipulate people. So, and that's one definition of cognitive empathy. It's like theory of mind, advanced theory of mind. They can guess, you know, what will please you, what will displease you, and then use that awareness to manipulate you.
Yes, it's what is that old course? What is it? How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah, Charles Manson's favorite book. Yeah,
yeah.
Right. There's something I was thinking a bit earlier when you were talking about this, the elite and their different psychology. It's also because it's on my mind because the blog post I'm writing today, and something that Dave O'Shan has been talking about, which has to do with how when we're cut off from our physical senses, we can't really connect to one another, and we can't really perceive life and existence, like you're saying, being with your cats or your wife. It's not just coming into us bodily. We're not just absorbing life. I won't go into what he described because it's quite complex. So I think it does relate directly to sexual abuse. Well, maybe I will mention it briefly because Dave talks about how we, people in that condition, they try and suck the world up through their asshole, and at the same time, because they've got no life force in their body, they're just in their head. They're just living in their heads, and the only energy that they have really is in their heads, and their bodies are like these zombies just trying to suck life out of the world through their asshole. And this is quite sort of poetic and symbolic language, but I got a sense from it, that's what I'm blogging about, that it related to sexual abuse, obviously, of children, kind of obvious correlation there potentially, but in my own life, to this desperate hunger for validation that we have. Because if we can't just receive the goodness of life through loving community with others and animals and nature, then there's this hunger in us that's never sated, and so we seek it in the world. So we seek validation in the world. And of course, that hunger would drive a person to be an overachiever. Right? So you could see how that would be congruent with this. How do you shape the child's psyche by trauma in such a way that they will continue the empire, to build the empire that I want to pass on to them, and make sure that they don't get too soft and let it slide?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, when most of us, normal people, it's like with our parents, I mean, really, they're just trying to, I think, more than anything, pass on their love and affection to us and the family bond and so forth. Whereas with the sons and daughters of the elite, it's a legacy that's being passed on to them that, they're under tremendous pressure to live up to in the first place. So, that's... even speaking as somebody who's, obviously, I'm sure you're probably far more, aware of this from your background. I mean, I came from a reasonably successful family. I mean, certainly not anywhere near, where yours were. But, certainly there has been a certain degree of pressure with my father's legacy. But, certainly, my parents never really believed that material things were necessary for happiness. And that was something that they were very big on pushing on to me, but I don't think a lot of people were as fortunate as I was in that sense. But yeah, it definitely can be very problematic when the only thing that your father wants to hand to you is a legacy that you're expected to live up to.
And the only, it was really reduced to a soundbite cliche and for me that I was aware of even very young, that my father, first of all, I got no love, so I'm going to be seeking love my whole life. Second of all, I don't know what love is like, fatherly love, anyway, because I never got it. So all I got was money, so then I'll be seeking money. I actually never was seeking money because I inherited it, but then I threw it away. So then I was seeking money after that. But I have been seeking, fame and validation and success, worldly success, which is just the larger context of money. And precisely, I think, because of that, there's this void in me that was never filled by the biological and beyond biological metaphysical requirement of a child, which is to receive absolute unconditional love from both parents.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, obviously that's not really possible when your parents and your father specifically are just preoccupied with whether or not you're going to go soft on them. You know, which I probably shouldn't surprise us that so many CEOs have demonstrable sociopathic personalities.
Well, yeah, in Hollywood and celebrities, I mean, this does seem like a unified principle for how the world is some kind of run by an informal, loose collective of seriously traumatized individuals with psychotic tendencies.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I think that's kind of where you get into like a subconscious level. I mean, is there something that was kind of guiding this just, you know, obsession to live up to your parentage or something to that effect? I suppose, you know, you could even look to mythology for this and the, you know, succession from the gods down to their sons and that type of thing. And, yeah. which obviously, I mean, in the ancient world, typically the aristocracy claimed direct descent from the gods. So, yeah, you know, I mean, there was this self-conscious identification with that, you know, all the way back then that obviously normal people didn't have at all in that case.
Right. That's a chicken or an egg question, then, isn't it? Because did these myths and these stories and these pantheons come, you know, did they create the kind of societies that we're talking about, the kind of aristocracies, or did the aristocracy create the myths out of their, you know, their own myth?
As a rationalization for, yeah, I mean, what they were doing to their kids. I mean, yes, it's definitely a major question of the chicken and the egg, no doubt.
Yeah, well, central to both anyway is hierarchy, and that was where I've been. It's been at the edges of my consciousness about half an hour now. I've been talking is the story of the elite essentially the story of hierarchy as compared to the story of nature, which is not hierarchical?
I mean, I suppose in a sense, I mean, especially when you're getting back to the earliest forms of religion, you know, with the pagan beliefs in Greece and Rome and Babylon and Hinduism and India and so forth, and almost all of these belief systems, there is a firm entrenched sense of a hierarchy that is derived from the gods, and then there's everybody else, which is, you know, essentially irrelevant. They're not godlike. They're just there to endure suffering and to labor for their social betters, essentially. But then you had a major transformation that began, I believe, around the 5th century BC or something, beginning with Buddhism and then going into the West with the advent of Christianity. And I know this will probably make a lot of secular liberals uncomfortable, but, you know, really this is where our whole concept of humanitarianism came from. I mean, that was really the novel thing about Buddhism and Christianity when they first emerged, was that they presented a new perspective. Everybody's life was equal. Everybody's life had value. It didn't matter if you were rich or poor. There was a divine spark in everyone, and I really think that was where empathy began to emerge as a socially ingrained characteristic and so forth. It was trying to get away from this concept of hierarchy and get back to the notion that everyone has value. Because I mean, I suppose in a sense, like you're saying with nature, you could draw that, but I mean, within nature itself, though, there are hierarchies. I mean, certainly I'm just kind of familiar with this with ants, for example, because I've been trying to kill them fanatically for the last couple of weeks since I had an infestation. But an ant colony is nothing without its queen, but I don't think that that's really true with humans, though.
Right. No, I did mean, but I was aware that that could be brought up with nature. I meant nature as an entire system doesn't appear to be a hierarchy.
Oh, yes, I see what you're saying.
But certainly within species there are hierarchies, yeah. Yeah, and also like the human body, it seems to me there's no hierarchy in the human body, although we can impose one on it and say, well, the heart is the king of the body because without it, it dies, or the brain and so on. But it seems to me that there's a system that's working cooperatively rather than competitively, whereas a hierarchy, maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, maybe hierarchies, whatever, has become itself misrepresented. I know there's a, I don't know, but I heard or I read that with the Egyptian hierarchical society, there was the belief that the slaves would eventually reincarnate as warrior and then priestly caste. Well, a caste is the Indian thing, but anyway, so there was this, you know, metaphysical view that everybody was potentially equal. But anyway, I mean, it also gets very complicated, doesn't it, to get into the metaphysics.
In a sense, too, I mean, I almost kind of wonder if we're now experiencing a sort of counter-revolution from what, you know, was unleashed by Buddhism and Christianity towards the end of the BCs. You know, obviously, it kind of read into this new perception that everybody's life had value, and it kind of seems like there's been a conscious effort to move us away from that concept. And that's kind of where I find it kind of striking that the kind of Hindu caste system has again started to have a certain appeal to a lot of people, especially when they start looking into these, you know, these ancient astronaut theories and what have you. It kind of seems like now there's almost an attempt to come up with a literal explanation for why there were hierarchies. Well, they had alien DNA in their, you know, genetics or something to that effect. And, you know, maybe they still have the alien DNA somewhere. And maybe that, you know, does make them our social betters if they do have these different genes. You know, it is interesting to see how all of that is currently playing out now.
Yes, well, that's very ancient, I guess, or at least relatively, or maybe not relatively, but it's been through history for quite some time. I mean, I have to watch that tendency myself because I was raised in it's probably even worse than being raised in an aristocracy, you know, an aristocracy that was in denial about its aristocratic aspirations, right, trying to be socialist. So, but whatever the case, I certainly was indoctrinated with elitism. And, I've been kind of dissolving it, or it's been getting rubbed off in the rock tumbler of my later life. Being poor helped, and then working in thrift store really helped. But at the same time, and there is a but in this, it hasn't allowed me to embrace the idea that we're all equal, because it's so obviously not true. I say, it's become more palpably true to me working in the thrift store, where some of the non-customers are just shit-faced drunk, and they always are that way, and they can barely form sentences, and you know that they're going to be dead in a week or a month or a year because their lives are simply lives of utter unconscious self-destruction. I mean, this is an absolute reality, and it would be foolish, you know, kind of misguided liberalism to pretend it wasn't. So one doesn't have to go from there to some sort of genetic theory, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, I think that's kind of the dangers, you know, when you deal in absolutes. I mean, equality is a wonderful thing in a lot of levels, but I mean, obviously, it's not absolute. I mean, you can't expect equal outcomes from everything. I mean, it's just not realistic to think that, you know, I mean, I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying this, but, you know, a 120-pound female could be as effective playing, you know, NFL football as a 250-pound male could be. I mean, unless we dramatically change the sport a lot and maybe, you know, I mean, allow the one to use steroids or something. But even then, it's just, yeah, you can't always have equality of outcome. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't make sense because the circumstances are different for each individual. And not just from birth, but from conception onward, and even going back, how far back are you going to go? So clearly somebody was born on a really fucked up ancestral line, not that I wasn't, but anyway, you know, their odds are not good that they're going to be very well functioning, and we can extend that to all of us, and this is the irony, isn't it, as we've got these overachievers who may be the most dysfunctional of all, but somehow they're rising to the top of the shit pile. But this, I mean, I don't think anything works by trying to look at, you know, trying to shuffle the facts and the data and, oh, look, there's equality here because this, that and the other. I think my view is the only thing that works, and unfortunately I also think it's the truth. Well, the truth is the only thing that works, but the only thing that works here for me is the truth, what I think is the truth, which is that we don't essentially exist separately as individuals anyway, that we're part of a collective intelligent system called humanity, and we're all completely interdependent. like neurons in a brain or in the intestines or in the heart or cells in a body. So there isn't, I mean, the whole idea of equality itself is based on a mistaken premise of individuality.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say also, I mean, we're all, I think maybe saying that we're all unique is a more apt thing than saying that we're all equal. We all have unique abilities, which can all contribute to the social well-being, so to speak.
In line
with what you're saying without the body, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the intestines couldn't pump blood as well as the heart could, to kind of give a ridiculous example. But I mean, they both have a useful purpose, though. I mean, you need both for the body to function properly, even if the heart may well be more prestigious than the intestines are.
Yeah, and one could even extend that to cancer cells or something. In the viruses would be the topical thing, in that they're only a response to some imbalance in the system, whether it's the ecosystem outside or the internal system of the body. But something's out of whack, and so then something emerges that's an attempt to correct the imbalance, right? So even, yeah, I mean, when I look at the drunks and all the rest of it, and the walking wounded in society, you know, around me in my town, I mean, it's very hard not to feel superior in a certain sense. I mean, or not to think, thank God that isn't me, but I don't think there's anything wrong in thinking that. But I also recognize that they're walking symptoms of something that has possessed us all.
And I mean, I think in some ways it might just be our, you know, our inability to find our own uniqueness and where exactly we fit into everything. You know, I've often wondered, you know, just how much of the societal problems derive from, you know, trying to pound, you know, square pegs into round holes, essentially. You know, a lot of people just simply don't have the opportunity to find the vocation or whatever that, you know, their own unique skill sets are best qualified for. You know, a lot of times that, in, you know, turn condemns you to a life of misery, just doing unfulfilling professions and things of that nature, because you just don't have the access or the knowledge to get to something that would be in line with what you're uniquely qualified to do.
Yeah, well, that's making me aware of something that I've been aware of for some time, but I mentioned it to my wife recently, that I tend to feel more affinity with many of these broken people that I meet in the thrift store, who socially speaking are pretty much good for nothing, but I feel more kinship with them than many more functional people who have managed to fit into society. And it's precisely for that reason that I think that some of the best of human beings now are in the worst of condition, because of that, because of the way that the system has tried to force them to be something that they're absolutely not. And
Or they do something that our society just doesn't value, essentially. I mean, you know, look at the top jobs in the country. I mean, banker, you know, stockbroker. I mean, it's really remarkable. But I mean, you know, when you look at some of the, just, you know, the most lucrative professions, I mean, when you think about it, if every lawyer in the, you know, the United States or the world or whatever just ascended or whatever tomorrow, we woke up and there were none left anymore, would it really mean anything to society, honestly? Certainly, though, I mean, if every mechanic in the world disappeared tomorrow, that would probably be horrendous in a lot of levels. But, yeah, a lot of lawyers, unfortunately, make a lot more money than mechanics do.
Yeah, well, that's a good, solid, simple point. Garbage men as well. I mean,
yeah, definitely. I mean, it's no doubt, I mean, a useful function that we all need, but and it's kind of ridiculous too, because I know when the whole thing with the cops, violence against cops, was a big deal a couple of years ago, I had even read an interesting statistic that your garbage man actually has a higher fatality rate than your local police officer does. But
wow.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of people usually when you think about a garbage man, you think that they're a piece of, you know, trash because they, you know, collect garbage, even though they're actually doing a job statistically speaking that's more dangerous than a police officer, and on top of that performs a very essential social service. But
why is it dangerous?
I would imagine probably being hit by drivers and what have you. I mean, I know where I live with just how narrow the road is and all the turns and what have you. There have been plenty of times where I've come up on the guard, just kind of going on a curve really sharp, and boom, the garbage truck is right there, you know. So it wouldn't
feel like, oh, it's just a garbage man.
Yeah. No, I mean, I could definitely see one of them getting hit on the road that I live on, and I'd imagine that's probably true of a lot of other parts of the country, too. So, yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, this is... it's all about community to me. I mean, so much of my attention is coming to this now, more and more, the need for community, the loss of community, and, you know, what is a community? How is a community made up? Well, it's made up... a community to work is, it has to be made up only of... you know, people doing things that are necessary for the welfare of the community, and that's it. You know?
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, to some extent, but again, you know, you could argue that storytelling isn't, you know, necessary for a community, but I mean, it's vital to the human condition, though. So.
Yeah, I didn't mean to reduce it to overly survival-based, but really, you know, people, like, cooperating and working together and helping the community to be a community and to be a lovely place to be. That's what I mean, right?
Yes. It's essentially doing things that have true, genuine value to people, which stories do. Whereas, you know, what you know, an investment banker does arguably has no real value to anyone other than other, you know, investment bankers and so forth. Or at least something we could probably find a way to fulfill their duties in a more humanitarian fashion, and one that would be much more beneficial to communities instead of international banks.
Well, so I wonder, you know, how much of this is to do with or inseparable from the global village that we've created, so that there's more and more middlemen, if you like, and there's more and more parasites who want to really call a spade a spade, because there's less and less of a sense of a community or a collection of human beings actually working together as a system in nature, the way that other species work together in nature, right? So then it's very difficult in a small community if there's somebody in there who's just parasiting, who's just exploiting, who's cheating and lying. It's not going to last long in the community because it's very obvious. But whereas when we've got this whole global economy and global society, this imbalance just perpetuates itself, you know, exponentially, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, it just doesn't, you know, dawn on a lot of people, like, well, does it really, you know, make sense that school teachers and nurses, you know, make so little compared to, like I said, you know, an attorney or something like that, even though, I mean, the former is obviously providing just an absolutely vital service to the community.
Right.
You know, and I think we've definitely lost touch with that. And certainly, I mean, not just globalism, but I think also, you know, the technology also kind of has us lose sight of that as well. You know, you really forget that you do need humans doing vital functions. You just can't have everything, you know, handled by an AI and some anonymous switchboard somewhere or something to that effect.
So would you feel optimistic if all of this was going to become unviable and that you had to end up just with a small bunch of people just trying to survive off the land?
I mean, you know, I do think in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, the most, you know, optimistic scenario of this would be us going back to a certain degree of regionalism. I mean, you know, obviously a certain degree of trade is desirable. You know, I mean, to kind of look at the absence of that and how it can affect people, you need to look no further than Europe and the Middle Ages. I mean, really, when the Roman Empire collapsed, communities had to become so totally self-sufficient, and there was a lot of benefits to that. But on the flip side of the coin, if you have a bad harvest for a couple of years, now you could have large-scale starvation. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, at least, I mean, a certain degree of interconnectedness in a global, you know, level isn't, you know, a bad thing. We can make our lives more or easier. We can, you know, cover up for, you know, major catastrophes and so forth with it. But yeah, I mean, I do think we need to get back to more viable communities, building things regionally where we're at, you know, and certainly so we can actually see firsthand how all of this interplays with one another in the community itself, instead of just, you know, one endless series of strip malls. I mean, you know, how is this going to affect a town or something to that effect, where, I mean, we're all working to sustain it and so forth. You know, I definitely think that there is a great potential to all of this and the upheaval. Now it's just a question of, can we, you know, put something that's actually going to be positive in place of the, you know, the collapsing global system, or whether we're just going to get something that's even worse as a replacement. Obviously, you know, we know what the powers that be are shooting for, but, you know, I kind of think like the Philadelphia mob family, perhaps they maybe have overstepped their boundaries a little bit. They've blown up too many mafia dons and too many suburbs now, and people just may not be willing to buy into it this time. We can only hope.
But then what would fill the vacuum? Would there not just be another succession drama playing out?
I mean, well, obviously, yeah. I mean, I think there, you know, chaos is almost unavoidable at this point in time. And, you know, that's something that's definitely going to take courage in a lot of the part of just basically normal people, you know. I mean, you're not going to have the certainty that you had in prior generations and so forth. You're going to have to be willing to take the plunge into the dark and, you know, hope that there is something that's better that's coming forward, and doing everything that you can to work towards something better.
And presumably the more local that, well, inevitably the more locally one's focus is, the more realistic that becomes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I used to play a game with my sister when we were younger about being on an island with 10 people, and we could just pick the 10 people we would end up with on the island. We used to play that game for fun because it was like a fantasy, really. But it started to become a little more realistic to me now.
Yeah.
Who would I want to just end up with in a little pocket somewhere while all of this comes down?
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, you know, there are definitely opportunities, I think, emerging. And I mean, you know, I think one of the good things with some of the, you know, the green movements that have been going on is it has led to more of a desire for, you know, locally produced food sources and things of that nature. And I think certainly with, you know, all the questions with, you know, viruses spreading, you know, through the global economy, I do think that that specifically is something that could be a great development from this. We get back to actually growing our own food, not just maybe necessarily with local farms, but I mean, we get back to the whole premise of victory gardens and things like that, which again, you know, was, you know, very common. I mean, most people historically usually grew a part of their produce, you know, going into the United States up into the 50s and so forth. So yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that we can be doing that would get us back in nature like that. I mean, you know, putting wholesome things into our bodies for a change. You know, I mean, I just think that's really the big thing, is that people need to stay positive. And I mean, they need to focus on, you know, what are the beneficial social changes that could come out of this and work towards those, which is really the important thing. I mean, don't just sit around and, you know, post Facebook posts about this. I mean, try to go out and do something constructive that's going to bring this about.
Absolutely. And prepare partly as well by going cold turkey, or maybe not cold turkey because that's all at once, isn't it? But weaning ourselves off our dependency on all the different forms of entertainment and distraction and support, and spending more time in nature, and just getting used to the possibility of living simple again, because I think that's what would undo a lot of people, would be the ruin of many people, is that they would just kind of go a bit batshit crazy if suddenly all they could do was try and grow vegetables and keep warm.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's a lot that can come from living simply again. And, you know, like I was kind of alluding to earlier, you know, I mean, if you know how to play an instrument, why don't you teach your little brother how to also, while this is all going on? Why don't you guys sit around and try playing some songs together, or singing something together, or telling each other stories? Instead of just, you know, fixating on the toxic culture that surrounds all of us, I mean, let's, you know, take the first step and start, you know, changing the narrative, come up with our own stories, our own songs, things that are going to point us towards a more socially positive and constructive age to come from all of this.
Mm-hmm. that book? Where's the it's out now, is it, or is it not yet?
Yes, it is out now. You can procure a digital copy by heading over to my blog. That is VisupView, VisupView, it's all one word, .blogspot.com. And it is also available on Amazon in physical copies if you are so inclined. But Amazon is taking a while to deliver right now. You would certainly get the digital one a little sooner, and we would get to keep all the profits on the digital one too, so that would be kind of nice. Also, I'm doing the podcast weekly. It's all one word, no hyphens or anything, just thefarmpodcast.com. You know, definitely check us out. And, you know, if you've heard anything interesting in this conversation, consider looking through the book. There's a lot of interesting topics that we cover in that. And, you know, I think it's pretty awesome myself, and hopefully the listeners will too.
Right, that is the end of my conversation with Recluse. You can go to his website via the link in the show notes and order his book that way. Next week's podcast will be some highlights from the last Limitless Meet, the post-mortem, post-apocalypse to the Dave Free event. I was informed yesterday that there's a new zine, online zine, that Daniel Pinchbeck started called Liminal Times, I believe it is. Certainly liminality is the theme, and of course I found that rather depressing. It has caused me to wonder if maybe it's time to change my brand, if something has become so fashionable. Something that I'm associated with, I mean, I probably won't, because I'm a bit tired of rebranding, and maybe it'll be a good thing, who knows, not to be associated with Pinchbeck, I mean, but to just to increase awareness of this thing. But anyway, I mention it because also last night, perhaps related, I had this dream about Eric Davis, who I've been thinking about on and off a little bit, terms of whether we'll ever have another conversation. He's received copies of my trilogy of social engineering. I've read his latest book, and I haven't heard back from him since then, even though his podcast is off and running. So I just have a feeling he's not really ready to go there. Anyway, in my dream, certainly my unconscious was playing that out. I dreamt that there was some sort of event, gathering, conference type thing or convention, and he was there, and he was making joints, rolling joints, and eating also super synthetic indica cannabis buds, just eating them raw like that, and so I felt a certain amount of disdain for that. And then I noticed a bit later, in the same dream, at the same event, that he had placed himself, almost like he was a tarot reader or something like that, on a mat on the floor where others were doing similar things, basically as to be observed by the milling crowds as he heavily tripped balls on this this cannabis. And he was drooling, and his eyes were buggy, and he was babbling like a deranged homeless person. He was sweating, he looked very old, and he was a right old mess. But he had submitted himself to this experiment, this self-experiment, and put himself under the microscope, so to speak, so let people observe the effects of this powerful cannabis hallucinogen. And I went over to him, and I was feeling a bit devilish, and I started saying to him, knowing that he was in this altered state, something about how I knew that he was an undercover agent and he was rumbled, or I can't remember exactly what, but it was a little bit malicious on my part. And I realized that actually I was being recorded, that he had left a recording device in front of him to record the whole thing, as part of the performance, and of course that I knew he would listen to this later on, but also that it was going to be aired. And although I had put on something of a different voice, or I was using my voice in a different way, I was pretty sure I would be recognizable. So then I had some misgivings. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that dream. Don't usually share dreams, but thought it might have some meaning and significance in there. That's it for one more week on The Liminalist. Thanks as ever for coming along for the ride. And I do encourage you to read my blog post and to try and put the pieces together and try and jump the fence of your own preconceptions about what you think's going on here, and to visit, attend and participate in what Deva Shan is doing, and also in what I'm doing in my life, Liminalist meetups. They won't generally be for guys only. The most current one is, but otherwise it's going to continue to be mixed. And that's where the real action is happening with me and or with Dave on live online interactive events.